spectacles on. This is case number 52835, Zhang versus Recon Trust Company. Mr. Eccles for the appellant, Mr. Cater for the respondents.
Carter, yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Is it Carter?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. A misprinter, Mr. Carter. Forgive me. Mr. Eccles?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors.
And let me also say that Justice Sada will listen, has been excused today, and she'll listen to this on the audio.
Okay. And Mr. Eccles, too, if I could add, you know, the three of us, by the way, yesterday kind of did this. We did a timeline kind of looking through what happened when in conjunction with the decision, so we appreciate this. But we were kind of one step ahead of you. We realized that was important. Let me get right to it. I can tell you the issue that concerns me is this, and you can, both sides can address it. The Supreme Court entered its decision reinstating the list pendants on December 29, 2004 by opinion. The release, I understand, was recorded September 14, 2005, so it's about 9 months later. So it's fraudulent to record that, so it's just a question of who bears responsibility. The loan was, I understand, was October of 2005, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And so having some experience in this area of the law, I know the title company probably looked at the release and thought, oh, it's released, we can insure title, and that's that, and didn't dig into the what happened in the case. Should they have to bear that responsibility? Can they look at a document that's been recorded, like a release of list pendants, and say, which happens all the time, as we know, it's a pretty common thing, or should they have been charged with looking at that case number at Blackstone and what happened with the underlying record in the case and where they would have found it had been reinstated, you know, months earlier?
Your Honor, at a minimum, they were at least on inquiry notice, because once they started to search title, I'm glad we have this timeline here, because once National Title started to search title, there was no void order on that property. It hadn't been recorded yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the briefs, really, they tried to blend this together. In that trial, they tried to blend it together as if they had seen both the Liz pendants and this void order at the same time. Really, there was a gap of 21 days. So the theory that they're relying on this release isn't really true, because once they had notice of the Liz pendants, and before they had notice of the void order, they had constructive notice. That's the statutory definition of a Liz pendants. It's constructive notice of the proceedings. And so they can't really rest on their laurels for those 21 days and say, we had no idea what was going on. Now, that's one of the reasons why the district court erred. Now, another one is, if the document is fraudulent, it really has no value. And even if a fraudulent document or a void document is actually recorded, then it still has no value. And the key case that we've relied upon is City of Los Angeles versus Morgan. In that case, the court says, it doesn't matter what you do with this document. It's void. It has no value. If you record it, it's like recording a blank piece of paper. And so the fact that the void order was recorded here really was of no value. And going more to your question, Your Honor, who should bear this responsibility? Of course, Ms. Zhang recorded her Liz pendants here. And the lenders want to say, well, we lent this money, we thought the Liz pendants was released. And that's really, that same issue is addressed in the Shudmack case. Now, the Shudmack case is from Louisiana appellate court case. And what the Shudmack case is, says the general rule is the public record doctrine. And it's actually the case that National Title relied upon at trial for the public record doctrine, which just says whatever's in the record, the title company can rely upon only that information, whatever is recorded against title, to find out chain of title, etc. Well, the public record doctrine in Shudmack didn't involve a Liz pendants. And so there's really an essential question of, does the public record doctrine even apply to a Liz pendants? Because on the one hand, the public record doctrine says only look at the title. On the other hand, NRS 14.010 says Well, you have constructive notice of everything that's in the proceeding. And so, if we do apply the public record doctrine to a list of pendants, then Shudmac provides an exception to the public record doctrine. That exception is anyone who has an interest in this property cannot be deprived of that interest, such as Ms. Zen. She had an interest in her list of pendants. According to Harrison B. Rice, once she entered into that binding contract with Sorachetti, she became the equitable owner of the property. And really, the only thing that Sorachetti had the power to give, well, he didn't have the power to give the title because it was no longer his. He was only entitled to receive the purchase proceeds. And that was, again, upheld in Herndon v. Grills by this court. Now, what Shudmac says, if somebody has interest in real property, they cannot be deprived of that interest without having notice. When there's fraud, error, or mistake, there has to be an exception to the public record doctrine. And Shudmac goes on to say, even in the hands of innocent third-party purchasers. So even if we have the lenders, who are the defendants in this case, and National Title, the title company, and of course the foreclosure trustees, Recon Trust, they can't throw up their arms and say, well, we didn't know. We're innocent parties. Well, that's the exception to the public record doctrine stated in the very case that they rely upon for the doctrine. Shudmac goes on and says, you know, a lot of times when holders of interest in real property have an interest, they don't find out that this has been challenged at any time until, in the case of a sale, until it's sold to a third party, or in our case, when it was refinanced and then the note was under foreclosure. The undisputed testimony, the only testimony, was that Ms. Zhang did not have notice that her interest of the Liz Pendants was being challenged until after Sorachetti's former counsel sent our office a letter and says, hey, we just want to let you know this note's under foreclosure. And, well, what note? You didn't give us notice that this void order was being recorded. Nothing in the four corners of this document shows that any notice was given to us or to Ms. Zhang directly. And then when National Title found the void order, they did not notify us. And so really that's what it comes, what should National Title have done? They should have notified us. That's right in the Shudmac case. Without that.
Well, let me ask you, so we've had another case, and long since this was briefed, it's recently been decided, a case called Endish, as the appellant, which I forget the exact name, but it involved an attorney who forged or signed a stipulation to dismiss a lawsuit, got a settlement, forged the client's name on the settlement check, and kept the money. And the defendant certainly dealt in good faith, thought the attorney had the authority to do that, and the Supreme Court granted, the district court did not dismiss that case. There was kind of a unusual remedy involved here. But have either one of you looked at that, or since it's recent, how this may play out in this bearing the loss type issue here? If you haven't, I understand. It's pretty recent then.
Your Honor, I remember when the case came out. I'm not familiar enough with the facts to discuss it today.
Yeah, I didn't expect that you would be, but I thought I'd mention it because I don't know if it's even applicable, but it's kind of this who bears the loss type thing for fraudulent conduct, and it's a very recent case. So I thought it might have some play. Either side might have some comments on it.
Sure.
Okay.
And so the three main reasons we think the district court erred are first, because it was a fraudulent document. Based upon all the authority that we found, a fraudulent document just simply has no value. It can't be resurrected, in a sense, once it's recorded. Now, the cases that the district court relied upon to find against us, Judge Williams found that the void order, in fact, became valid once it was recorded, because there was nothing on the actual document that said this is a void document. Well, I don't know when that's ever going to happen. But the corporate representative of National Title, who is Philip Bouchard, we took his deposition and he also testified at trial. What we did is we first subpoenaed him for a deposition to find out what happened. And he said, well, upon looking on this at the time of the deposition, I think this order looks like a forgery to me. Well, it's because it was all in handwriting, and how many attorneys really use handwriting for cover sheets. And really what the problem with the cover sheet is, the cover sheet's the only place on this order where it says it's a release. Now, under NRS 14.017, in order to cancel a list pendants, you have to have a certified court order, and it has to be recorded as well. Certainly the cover page here that says release was not certified by any court or ordered by any court. And so if you look only at the court order itself, it says it's an order dismissing complaint. You take the document at face value, it does not comply with NRS 14.017 because it doesn't cancel the list pendants. Now, the argument that's made by the respondents is that, well, you know, there's these other cases that say there's an ostensible release or it's an exception to these types of strict statutes. And a dismissal of the entire litigation is essentially the same thing as a release. So we were okay to put our deeds on it. Now, the problem is those cases that provide that exception, and it's their burden to prove the exception, those cases say you have to have a final order. The litigation has to be completely over. What that means is the entry of a final order in the district court and no appellate review. In this case, of course, we had neither. The litigation was ongoing, and there was appellate review. Now, what Judge Williams, in his judgment, in his order, he says, well, if you knew that the Supreme Court had issued this order, why don't you record that onto the title? Well, I already had the list pendants. That's constructive notice of everything, including the Supreme Court's writ petition, writ of mandamus, that was filed in the district court. The fact that I wasn't given notice that anything was challenging my list pendants means that I don't have to reaffirm my list pendants. I don't have to go and monitor the title and find out if there's some fraud being taken place.
Did you know the district, you knew the district court, though, had entered an order expunging the list pendants? So.
Well,
I mean, it hadn't been recorded. They entered it, you know, properly. Then when they did it, expunge it, it was reinstated by the Supreme Court. So there was an order floating around out there.
Right. And what happened is the district court entered the order granting motion to dismiss as well as the order canceling the Liz pendants. Now, the order canceling the Liz pendants, which may have had a little bit more legitimacy, was never actually recorded.
Right.
And within the text of that order, it actually says this order is stayed, which would have raised the red flag had that been recorded.
I see.
And so there were a continual stay through the district court and then from this court pending the resolution of our writ petition.
So on July 2nd, there was an order canceling list pendants, but it's never recorded, and also there was a stay involved there. So
that's correct.
And what about the 8304 Supreme Court order? Did anybody think about recording that, staying the expungement?
Now, we didn't have any reason, Your Honor, to record anything. Had we known, under the Shudmec standard, had we known that Sorcetti had recorded this during the midst of his secret refinance, of course we would have recorded any of these orders. You know, when National Title went and searched title to this property, undoubtedly, they had to call U.S. Bank, which was the holder of the underlying deed of trust, to ask them what their payoff amount was for their deed of trust. They should have done the same thing. It would be a simple phone call or a fax. Is this Liz pendant still valid? Or is this order that we've received, is it valid, this void order? If there are no other questions, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve my
time. And I'm confused. The order, the one order had the stay in it, the original one.
That was the order canceling.
Right. What was the order that was recorded then? How was it different?
There were two separate orders. The order granting the motion to dismiss, all it said was Zhang's complaint against Sorcetti is dismissed in its entirety.
Okay.
And it didn't have any language in there about releasing the Liz pendants or doing anything. But there was the counterclaim, which is why we had to seek extraordinary relief from this court.
Okay.
Because there's no final order.
I get it. I understand. Thank you.
I think you have 2 minutes and 20 seconds left. And now Mr. Carter. Carter with an R.
Thank you, Your Honor.
For the respondent. Cross appellant.
Matthew Carter and Jennifer Dorsey on behalf of the respondents, Recon Trust, Countrywide Home Loans, Silver State Financial Service, and National Title Company. Your Honors, this court, Justice Gibbons in particular, got down to two very vital issues at the heart of this case.
That's because he did this in his practice. He knows what he's doing, folks. I rely on him on these cases.
It made our jobs a lot easier because you're absolutely right, Justice Gibbons. Those are two absolutely critical issues at the heart of this case. And if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to start with those issues and discussing those. And the first one is, what is the obligation of a title company when it's searching the record? Because, as you know, Your Honor, and as we cited in our brief, the authorities on this are very clear. And in particular, the Flage versus Flynn and the Greenpoint mortgage cases, specifically when they talk about what can provide notice in the record, there is a short list of documents that the whole world is on notice of and a title searcher has in front of them when they can tell what litigations or what interest affects the property. And those cases make it very clear as a matter of law that a title searcher does not go outside of that short list of documents regarding what litigations and what interests affect that property. In the Greenpoint mortgage case, which is a 2005 case from the High Court in Maryland, discusses this particular fact and this obligation in great detail, going back all the way to the 17th century, when Liz Pendens were in it, when the idea was first conceived of. And what the court found was that it's not necessarily a perfect system when you have only these particular documents that the title searcher is looking at, but the alternative is what the appellant is essentially requesting in her appeal, which is a system where a title searcher must not only look at the short list of documents, they must also independently verify every single one of those documents in the record, call the people who recorded them, and ensure that they are, in fact, what they purport to be. In this particular case, Your Honor, Justice Cherry, you were asking about what exactly was the document that was recorded. It was a document that was dismissing the appellant's complaint in this case. And that document had a cover page on it, which purported to be from appellant's counsel, Scott Marquis, Marquis and Arbach. Now, while there's never a finding in the lower court about who actually did record this, but it's probably safe to say that Scott Marquis didn't record it, but we don't know who did it. The point is, though, subjectively, in the mind of the title searcher, in this case, Lewis Southers at National Title, what could he determine from looking at these documents, which Greenpoint Mortgage, in this case, in Flage versus Flynn, we also cited Dyer versus Martinez, in this very specific universe in which he has to look to see what affects this property, what could he have determined? And what he can determine from this list is that there was no litigation affecting the property at this point. Now, something that Mr. Eccles made a point about was that, well, the original Liz Pendens was found, and then there was 21 days, and then the release order was found. So what do we do with that? And in order to explain that, Your Honor, I'd have to take you back to the trial testimony of Mr. Philip Bouchard, who explained a little bit about the procedure. And it's not quite as simple as National Title going to the county recorder's office and saying, what documents do you have on this property? There's actually a title plant for Clark County, which is co-owned by several of the title companies. And this title plant receives documents from the county recorder's office, and it indexes them in a way that they can most easily conduct the title searches that they need to do for their job. Now, the title plant is always going to be a few weeks behind the county recorder's office because it takes time to get those documents and to properly index those. So in this case, when Mr. Bouchard was testifying, he said that the release order in this case, there was going to be a little bit of a delay simply because of that process. It's not simply that someone from National Title was researching this property on the 6th, found this order and said, gee, let's wait and see what else pops out. The fact is that the title search process was not complete at that point. It wasn't complete until the title plant, you know, on the 21st, you know, pops out whatever other documents there's going to be, which is when this dismissal order came to the attention of National Title. So that is the actual process that happened. And in that context, when we're talking about the obligation and what they knew about when, it's far more complex than it would initially seem to the layperson, which, again, not to jump around, but that also went to the negligence issue and what is the duty of care in this case, which is why expert testimony would have been so vital on their point at trial. Now, the second part that you asked about, Justice Gibbons, was who should this responsibility fall on? If a document or Liz Pendens is misindexed or it's not recorded correctly, whose fault is this? And I talked about the Greenpoint mortgage case out of Maryland a little earlier, and that was a case that is directly on point to this one. In that case, there were two banks, like my client, that had recorded deeds of trust against a property that was the subject of a divorce action. And in that divorce action, the receivers had recorded two Liz Pendens in two different counties, but those Liz Pendens were slightly flawed in that the names of the husband and the wife, which I guess were unisex or they were a little bit strange, they had been flipped so that when the banks were getting the deeds of trust on this property, they didn't understand from a review of the records that any interest they got from the husband, who was the one taking out the deeds of trust, they didn't understand that any interest they got to him would be subject to this litigation that was pending elsewhere. And so because of that misindexing, the deeds of trust, the loans went through, the deeds of trust were recorded, and the receiver sued for priority, much of the appellant has done here. Mm-hmm. And the court was faced with exactly the issue that's before you here today, which is who does this responsibility go to, which was why they spent such an exhaustive amount of time looking at the history of the Liz Pendens and what should be done. And what the court said was, even though it's not a perfect system, the entire system of real property in this country depends upon this idea that the title searcher must be able to look at these documents and tell what's going on with the property. And if they can't do that, then they're going to have to review thousands, if not millions, of documents. The court actually went to the extent of saying, well, you know, how many cases were filed in this court last year? So how many of those would they have to review documents from? And they actually came to a number that was in the millions. And they said it would be virtually impossible to determine clean title on any property when you're doing any conveyance or you're doing any kind of mortgage or anything like that. And so this isn't a perfect system, but if you have innocent title searchers in banks who are looking at acquiring an interest versus a party on the other side who has actual notice of a litigation, as appellant did here, the ultimate risk of that misindexing, of that misrecording, is going to have to go on the appellant. And that's exactly what happened here, Your Honor, because in the context of Liz Pendens, maybe a more literal analogy would be she is sticking a flag in the property. And that flag says there's a litigation, and whatever is going on here is going to be subject to this litigation. Well, somebody, again, we don't know who, because the district court didn't make a finding, came along and yanked that flag out of the property. So by the time my clients came along, they saw these reported documents, they said, well, there's no flag, because this case is over. According to the reported documents, it looks like we can do this. And this is absolutely analogous to the Greenpoint mortgage case, where even though the reality of the case in the Liz Pendens is much different, the court should instead go with what is reflected in the document. And that this is also a case, one of the cases that the court relied on below, which was Dyer versus Martinez, was essentially an accord to the Greenpoint mortgage case. It was decided after that, but I don't believe it actually referred to Greenpoint mortgage case, but it was the same sort of thing.
I get, and I agree with you. I mean, everything you said makes sense, but here's my problem is with the title companies all the time do title reports, and let's say a judgment shows up. Maybe the judgment's paid. I mean, I used to get calls constantly if I recorded a judgment, has this been satisfied? Maybe it was, and somebody just didn't record the satisfaction of judgments. So there's with litigation, there's always little unusual things that happen. Would a Liz Pendens be different than, let's say, a deed of trust, a grant deed, other documents that you're describing that's impossible to track down, reconveyance, deeds of reconveyance? would a list pendants be kind of like a judgment where you there's a duty of inquiry to maybe check the status on what's going on? That was the thought that went through my mind reading all these materials, you know, like that. What's your thoughts on that? Is that something different than maybe these normal conveyance documents?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely it is. That's an excellent question, and that was one of the points that I was going to discuss with you here today, is that one of the main problems here in this case is that the appellant is mixing burdens between a conveyance or a judgment or something and a list pendants. They're two separate areas of the law. Mm-hmm. A list pendants is not an actual conveyance. It's not creating or destroying an interest in property. If you look at NRS 14.010 subsection 3, that statute specifically describes a notice of pendency of action as notice, not as a conveyance of real property.
Well, it's an exception to marketable title, like a judgment would be an IRS lien, something like that. So would you agree with that?
Correct, Your Honor. It is a cloud on title. It's not necessarily a conveyance. And all of
I know it's not a conveyance, but it's an maybe I shouldn't have said that. It's an exception to marketable title. I mean, my concern is you may have a fraudulent. Somebody could write a deed conveying Mr. Eccles' house to you, get a fraudulent notary, and you know the title company say, well, it's a conveyance, you know, like that. Things like that happen, and I understand there's not much title companies can do with that. But with these court documents, judgments, things like that, they can kind of check into them and see what's going on.
Yes, I think I understand your question, Your Honor, and you can stop me if this is incorrect. And I think this goes back to the City of Los Angeles versus Morgan case that was being cited by Mr. Eccles. That was not actually a Liz Pendens case. That was a case in which a void judgment was recorded against a piece of property, I think in 1924, and the void judgment because it hadn't necessarily been served upon all the parties involved. So as a matter of due process, it wasn't going to work. And then in 1951, someone is asserting basically a successor interest based on that deed. And that was an issue of constructive notice, but not with regard to a Liz Pendens. It was more akin to like an adverse possession kind of action. This person said, well, look, this has been recorded since 1924. You should have known this was on here. Therefore, this is my property now. And the court considered that and they said, no, not in this case, because this is not the sort of thing where you can just record a void judgment, which would be a conveyance in property. In this case, it was the whole property. And you can use constructive notice in an offensive way to make a fraudulent title good. And a Liz Pendens would be different in that way because, again, as I said, there's not the interest that comes along with the judgment. And the other thing is, too, in terms of a Liz Pendens with as opposed to a judgment, there's another significant difference in that when a Liz Pendens is involved, necessarily there always has to be litigation involved. You're going to have a plaintiff or some kind of claimant recording the Liz Pendens against the property. And which means they have counsel, which means they're aware of these issues. And if the question is it going to be too much of a burden for that counsel to check weekly, periodically, to see if anything's been recorded, I think the answer is of course not. Now, there's one other issue on this fraud point that I would like to get before the court, because there was a recent case that, oddly enough, also came out of Maryland, the Court of Special Appeals, a few months ago. They apparently have a lot of these. It's Washington Mutual Bank versus Homan, which the site is 974 A2D 376. And that was a case which addressed the issue of what happens when there's fraud and a deed of trust sort of results from the fact that the person getting the loan has committed a fraud, but the bank isn't necessarily in on it. And what that court said was, and I'll quote, it is well settled that in circumstances where a deed is set aside for fraud, a mortgagee, not a party to the fraud, is entitled to the protection afforded a bona fide purchaser by a court of equity to the extent of his or her interest. And this wasn't a rule that the Maryland Court of Special Appeals just dreamed up of their own accord. They actually cited a number of other cases, one from Alabama, I believe, and Illinois and Missouri, and I'm really sorry I don't have the cites for you right now. Mm-hmm. But apart from the whole argument that, you know, a Liz Pendens is not a conveyance, and they're basically mixing the burden of a conveyance law with constructive notice law, there's the more important point here that the the bank was not a party, assuming that there was any fraud, because, again, the district court didn't find it, but assuming that there was, my clients were not involved in that fraud at all. And therefore, under Washington Mutual Bank, this policy makes sense that it's not fair to my clients to make them lose $700,000. And again, it's not perfect to put the risk on the appellant either. But in this case, the appellant had actual knowledge of the litigation and what was going on. And like Justice Cherry said, they could have just as easily recorded the Supreme Court orders, and there would have been no problem. We wouldn't be sitting here today. So as between the party who is not a party to fraud, who has no knowledge, and the party who has actual knowledge and reported to Liz Pinden, that responsibility should clearly go to the appellant. And I see that I'm running out of time here. So
yes, you are.
If there are any other questions the court has, it'd be fine. Otherwise, I'll sit down.
Thank you very much. Mr. Eccles, rebuttal?
Mr. Eccles, maybe you could answer that last point. I mean, he does make a pretty good point. Now, frankly, I don't think I've ever seen a Supreme Court order recorded in my life, but, I mean, theoretically, if that could have been done when the writ was issued and all that, he's right. That would have, this couldn't have happened. So what's your comments on that?
You know, I find it really interesting that at this point in the game, he hasn't given me this case law that he's relying on, and he's now trying to run from the case law that he relied upon at trial, which is the Shudnack case. Now, what he does is he says that we had notice of the status of the litigation. Of course, they did too because of the Liz Pendence. Now, what we didn't have notice of is that the Liz Pendence was being challenged on the title. That's the notice that we needed, according to Shudnack. And this Washington Mutual case is really at odds from the very doctrine that they relied upon, the public record doctrine. And in our reply brief, we cited to the exception. We said, okay, if Judge Williams is going to rely upon the public record doctrine to say that they didn't have to do anything, then you have to take the exception. There's fraud, error, or mistake. And Shudnack says, yes, there's this weighing of equities, but we had our interest in the property first. And so that's where it should not be impaired. Fraud cannot impair this. And Shudnack goes on and even says, you know, even if there's innocent third parties, bona fide purchasers for value, it doesn't matter. Because you came after us. Your deeds of trust came after us. We were here first. You know, that's basically the purpose for title insurance. And the title company they have an indemnity agreement that was presented at trial. It's in the record with Sorchetti. It was their choice to loan him this money. Now, one other point I want to bring up in the remaining time I have. Huntington v. Milas says that if they have notice of documents that are in the record, and they choose not to go and look to see what they are, they're still charged with that notice. That's what happened here. When they had the actual notice of Liz Pendence, before they discovered the void order, they are charged with what the search would have shown, which would have been the true status of the litigation and that, in fact, this was a void order. Now, there was this case that Mr. Carter talked about, misindexing. Just to be clear, there was no misindexing problem in this case at all. The Liz Pendence was properly indexed, properly recorded, completely valid. The Dyer and Flige cases that Judge Williams relied upon, those cases talk about when I have no Liz Pendence. If you don't record anything, I don't have constructive notice of what that is. We don't have any case in the record that talks about removing the constructive notice. So it's really an inopposite set of cases. Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Cherry, can I make a request?
Sure, absolutely.
On this case, Justice Sada also is participating, and she couldn't be here this morning, but this case I mentioned, Endish versus Endish DBA Valley Hospital versus, and I forget the name of the respondent, but it's within the last 2 months that the courts entered this opinion.
Sure.
Again, it's fraudulent conduct by an attorney. It's not a title company or anything. But there's analysis in the cases when you have two innocent parties. You know, how do you deal with it? And I don't know if it even applies here. But I would request from Justice Cherry, if he is presiding justice, if he would give you each an opportunity just to do a supplemental brief, real short, on that one case. That would be it. We don't have to reopen these other issues.
Certainly.
And see if you feel it applies or doesn't apply and how it affects your particular particular client's point of view on this particular case.
More than happy.
And again, this is unusual, but once in a while you get these case law comes down in between the briefing and the argument. It may have an impact on the disposition, and I know what the three of us have discussed this, and this case is troubling because we both sides represent innocent people have been victimized by fraud of a third party, and mm-hmm. those are really tough cases because you're trying to do what's right and follow the law, but they're probably the toughest ones to handle.
Should we give them 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 30 days? What's convenient? It's the holidays coming up. I don't want to interfere with that.
Yeah, right.
30 days, and we'll blind brief it. Just both of you just send it in within 30 days. Then just
no. I think they send it to each other.
Oh, send it to each other. Okay.
Right. 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 And the issue I'm interested in is who bears the loss when you have a fraudulent conduct by a third party, and if this case is applicable at all to this Zhang.
That case was a Larry Davidson case where he forged the settlement agreement, and it was a question about Valley Hospital eating it or the Davidson's clients. So you want to take a look at it. So let me make sure we have the process here. They have 30 days.
And they serve each other.
Serve each other.
And us.
And us. Right. Make sure that we all get
it. I may also request leave to...
They're limited to 10 pages.
Okay, certainly. Now, if I may also request leave to respond to the Washington Mutual case that was just brought up today. That's the first time I've heard of it. Was that in the briefs?
It was not. It came out after the briefing schedule, Your Honor. It was June of this year.
What do you want me to do on that?
Well, I would think that as long as each side's limited to 10 pages, if you wanted to mention it.
Within your 10 pages.
I mean, I think we can read it, though. We can figure them out of what impact they have.
Okay.
All right, this case will not stand submitted until